You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Thanks so much for reading so much and such a long story. It's one of those stories as a child that captivated my entire imagination. But one of the most important questions that you're going to answer in your life is, what do you believe? Like, that is one of the primary questions hanging over your life. What will you trust in? Because your answer to that question will steer everything in your life. It will become the de facto mode of how you decide things, where you go, how you live, how you treat other people, what you expect, not just in this life, but the next. The big question is, what do you believe? It's a profound question. Some of you in this room have no idea. You're like, that's why I came. I want to know what it is to believe. I want to know, I want to understand who this Christian God is and those sorts of things. And just to let you know, you're in the right spot. You've made the right decisions coming to listen and to learn. You might actually catch this thing called Christianity. But others of us, some of us are filled with complete confidence in what we believe. We can recite creeds and Bible verses. You might even have statements of faith crocheted and put on your wall. You might have really great mugs with cool graphics that tell you each morning what it is that you believe. You never waver, you know. You even shop at Hobby Lobby. Like, that's how firm your faith is. But most of us, if we're really honest, have a pantheon of beliefs that we deploy in whatever situation we come about. If it's a matter of security, we might just say we believe in the dollar. If it's a matter of happiness, we have complete confidence in our ability to control our environment and create the happiness that we want. If it's a matter of approval, we trust in our ability to perform well enough so that people will like us. And on, the different gods and the different beliefs come. And in the midst of it, we might say, sure, I believe in God also. One theologian writes that the main temptation today is not to reject God outright, but to make him secondary. The main temptation for Christians who come and who sit in this room, who know the songs and know the verses, the main temptation for you is not that you'll walk out the door and you'll somehow reject the faith entirely and leave and go to something else. The main temptation for you is that you will make God an afterthought, a nice tradition, a good cultural practice for you, a nice way to live a moral life. A famous atheist, Richard Dawkins, who spent his entire life trying to critique very harshly the Christian faith, he recently made this point in an interview that he did with the BBC. In it, he said, "Obviously, I'm not a believer, but there is a distinction between being a believing Christian and a cultural Christian." He goes on to say, Dawkins says, "I love hymns. I love Christmas carols." This great atheist says, "I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos." He says, "We're a Christian nation in that sense." And then he goes on to tell us what we should do. He says, "We ought to maintain that kind of Christian flavor. But obviously, that's different than believing." Unfortunately, Richard Dawkins isn't describing just his atheistic worldview. He's kind of describing one of the default methods of living the Christian life. Lovely hymns, good feelings, nice morality. But then in the nitty-gritty of life, when things count, God is something secondary, not someone to believe in. Just an afterthought. I love today's passage because it forces us to ask that question. What do I believe in the real life, in the nitty-gritty of the circumstances that come my way. Ancient Israel was a lot like us in that way. This summer, we've been reading through 1 and 2 Kings, and so far, what we've seen is that some kings start off really well, but then finish poorly, primarily by doing this thing of making God something secondary. And throughout all of that, the country spirals out of control. People have completely divided hearts, and they live in a pantheon of beliefs just like us. But what God does is he graciously intervenes through prophets. The prophets are God's grace to interrupt our lives by making himself clear, by making his power known, by calling people to remember who God is and what he's really like. Almost every time the prophets, in one way or another, come to the people or to the king and they ask them, in some sense, what is it that you believe? Followed by, then act like it. The prophets are tough people. Today's passage is one of those amazing moments as the prophet Elijah calls the people of Israel to this mountain and he confronts their wavering beliefs. He exposes their fake God, and then he reveals God's power. And hopefully, as we go through this text, we'll see God graciously interrupt our lives too. Whether you're here just trying to figure out what you believe, or you feel like you've got it all under wraps already, hopefully God will interrupt our lives and lead us back to belief in him. And so turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 18. I'm going to start at 19. It's also on page 279 in the pew Bibles in front of you. 1 Kings chapter 18, starting in verse 9, Elijah says this to King Ahab. He says, "Send and gather all of Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, those who eat at Jezebel's table." And so Ahab did this. He sent to all the people of Israel, and he gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people, and he said, "How long will you go limping or wavering between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And then the people did not answer him a word. This confrontation with Elijah and the prophets and the people was a really long time coming. It had been over 50 years since the kingdom split and the people began to worship this counterfeit religion that we talked about last week. And what followed was generation after generation, really quick ones as the kings kind of killed each other. There were coups, there were assassinations, but each king was worse than the last. All kind of building on these small compromises of Solomon and Jeroboam, all the way until King Ahab and his wife, Queen Jezebel, who they don't simply maintain that false worship, they add to it. They bring in gods from the other nations around them, and they hunt down the prophets of God, so much so that there's only one left, and his name is Elijah. Elijah's not special, he's just the only one, which can be comforting to us. You don't have to be special, you can just be the only one left. And the country then was filled with lawlessness. There was child sacrifices. People would sacrifice their children to build things. There was gross abuse of the weak and the vulnerable. The country didn't set out on this course to just be one of the most horrendous societies ever, but that's where they ended up, primarily through having a divided heart, a nation internally divided with their beliefs between this new God that was brought with Queen Jezebel, Baal, and then the God of the Bible of their ancestors. And so first God calls Elijah to bring a drought that lasts for 3 years. And then when the drought was over, when the time was just right, Elijah came to the king and he said, "Gather all the people together, come close to me on Mount Carmel." And this is when Elijah confronts them. He says, how long will you continue to waver between two opinions? So on one hand, they trusted in Baal. I know you're not ancient Canaanite religion philosophers, but this is who Baal is. Baal was a god from the northern kingdom of Sidon. He was the high chief god in their sort of pantheon that they had built. He was in charge of the weather, fertility, agriculture. He provided wealth, he provided abundance, and all the other gods were supposed to answer to him. Baal was very popular in Israel. He was kind of the spirit of the age. He was the consensus thinking, oh, do you have a problem? You should go to the prophets of Baal. Oh, you have a need? Things aren't working out for you in your life? You should go see Baal. He will take care of you. He was the default choice. Baal was also the god of the rich, the famous, the elites, the powerful. Ahab and Jezebel loved this god. They went to his prophets just like the rest of the people. They built temples. They built highways to these temples. The prophets of Baal advised them on everything. They trusted that Baal was good. Baal was also very convenient for just the way that humans think. He made sense. With Baal, there was this system of an exchanging of goods, of quid pro quo. If you give something to Baal, he'll give you something back. He has the power to make your dreams come true. All you have to do is get on his good side. Give him the right color M&Ms, you know? Make his room comfortable. Give him wonderful sacrifices, and then Baal will come through for you. If you want a really big thing, then you have to give him a really big thing. Baal was a simple trade market, a simple exchange. And then on the other side was God. Yahweh, the God of Israel. No one in the inner circles of power openly worshiped God. God wasn't popular, the de facto choice. There was only one guy left after all. God was different from Baal. He didn't have a system of exchange of goods. There was no give God more stuff, you'll get more rain. There was no better crops, better cultural influence that came from the gifts that you gave to God. In fact, you didn't sacrifice to the God of Israel to get him on your good side or to get things from him. You couldn't manipulate this God. You couldn't buy him. God simply does what he does. He redeems, he restores, he works, he operates. And in response, the people are to worship, to confess, to acknowledge, to thank him, to be right with him, to remember. The festivals for the God of the Bible were all designed around remembering what God had already done. They weren't designed for them to make all these sacrifices so that God would be pleased with them. It was designed by a God who was already pleased with them, who had already redeemed them, who had already rescued them, and that they came and they did these festivals primarily to remember or to say, we want to be right with God. Yet Yahweh, this God, the God of the Bible, was neglected. He was their heritage. He was their background, he was their tradition, and so there was some lip service to the God of Israel. There were a few occasional festivals that they had set up, a few important days. They were divided between these two beliefs, Baal and Yahweh. And Elijah asks them, how long are you going to continue to waffle between the two? How long? It's important to understand that Elijah isn't primarily concerned with their religious practices, though that's important and it's grotesque what the prophets of Baal did. He's not there saying, you need to figure out which temple you're going to attend. No, what Elijah is talking about is you need to figure out which of these gods you trust. Which of these gods are you going to go to? Which of these will you believe in? And he makes this challenge to them. He says, if the Lord is God, follow him. But then if Baal is God, follow him. Which one is real? Which one's truly powerful? Devote yourselves to that God. Because if Baal is truly God, if he controls the weather, if he makes things grow, if he creates children, if you can truly rely on him and trust him to do all the stuff that he says he can do, Elijah says, if he's like that, follow him. Give him your undivided devotion. But if he's not, you should drop him. And in the same way, Elijah says, if the God of Israel is true, if he's real, if he really is the maker of all things, who considers his people, who redeems, who has compassion, who brings peace and justice and loving kindness, if he's God, you should follow him. You should give him your complete devotion. You should build your entire life around his character, around his presence. You should plan your days, your weeks, your years around worshiping him. If Yahweh is God, you should meditate on all of his instructions. You should apply his wisdom to all things. You should fear him, give him glory, rely on him for all of your sense of identity, purpose, forgiveness. If the God of the Bible is real, you should follow him. And if he's not, don't. Elijah doesn't waver. It's a pretty bold statement. If he's not real, don't follow him. If your God is real, follow him. It's quite simple. You should only give your life and beliefs to things that are real, that have the power to fulfill their promises. For example, if your career can fulfill all of your longings for significance and self-importance and security and belonging, if your career can do all of that and give you the power and glory that you seek, if it's truly powerful in that way and divine, then you should follow it. Maybe a little smaller example, but no less significant, is if that one person's approval, you know, your boss, your spouse, your friend, your coworker, if their approval can really make you whole and well and good, then by all means, go for it. See, what Elijah is graciously and also snarkily saying is, the very least you can do in life is know that what you believe in is real. It's the bare minimum you can do in life. Is know that what you're trusting in is actually real. And the most you can do in life is build your entire life around that belief. That's why he says, if he's God, follow him. But the very worst way, Elijah is saying, the worst way to spend your life is limping between all the things as if they're equally real. Elijah's confrontation is simple. Stop wavering between beliefs. Whatever is true, follow that. And so we might think, that's great. Now I know. I need to go home and do my own research. I need to go on my journey of self-evaluation, figure out what it is that I believe. I need to discover the truth, discover what sparks joy for me. I need to eat, pray, love. And then I'll decide what to follow. But God's gracious intervention doesn't stop just with confronting our dualism, our divided hearts. The prophets always expose the fake gods and our feeble trusts. And that's what happens next. Elijah creates this setting for us to see who is the real God. Continuing in verse 22, this is what Elijah says to the people. He says, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it into pieces and lay it on the wood, but don't put fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I'll call upon the name of my God. And the God who answers by fire, that is God. And the people answered, that's well spoken, or sounds good to me. Here, Elijah's contest is set up to prove which one is real. Each of the prophets are simply going to sacrifice their own bull, and then they're going to pray. They're going to ask their God to respond with fire, and whichever one actually does that is the real God, worthy of trusting. The one who hears their prayers, the one who sees their sacrifice, the one who responds is God. Just a side note, that is a really good test. If the thing that you worship and trust cannot hear you, cannot see you, cannot respond to you, what's the point, right? So the prophets of Baal go first. And this is what happens with them if you continue in verse 25. Elijah says, "You go first. Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it. For you are many, and you can call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given to them, and they prepared it, and they called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud, and they cut themselves, as was their custom, with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. The prophets of Baal called and prayed for hours, from morning until noon, and that's when Elijah starts to mock them. They're in the middle of their trances. They're reciting cantations. They cut themselves until blood is gushing out of them, all to get Baal's attention. The mockery is pretty fantastic. He says, "You should get louder. After all, he's God, isn't he?" Maybe he's really deep in thought. You know, sometimes when you're really thinking, your children have to scream louder. You scream louder. Maybe he's going to the bathroom. Keep yelling. Maybe he's on vacation. We all like vacations. Maybe your God's on vacation. Maybe he's taking a nap. I mean, we take naps. Surely Baal takes naps too. After all, he's fixing the whole world. He's giving people what they want. He's making deals. Maybe he's tired and taking a nap. And in the end, Baal is exposed. They raved, but nothing happened. Not even a spark, not even a voice, not even a whimper. The text says there was no voice, no response. They bled for Baal, but no one was there. The text says no one answered. They wailed, they made noise, but no one listens. The text says no one paid attention. Baal didn't respond because he couldn't. This is where all worship of empty hopes ends. This is religious fervor without the reality of God. You'll cry out, give fake gods everything, and they won't answer you. The pursuit of empty gods always ends in an exhausting, deflating anticlimax. It's like the end of The Wizard of Oz, when all of their hopes for a brain and a heart and courage and a return ticket home, when all of their hopes come crashing down when they realize the wizard is just a man behind a curtain. The myth is actually a mirage. He has no power, and they've realized they've walked down the long yellow brick road and made all of the sacrifices to get to the end, and the guy at the end is nothing, has no power to do anything. See, counterfeit gods are like Baal. They will bleed you dry and leave you holding the tab every time. They'll consume your emotions. They'll take your time and your talent. They'll take your families and they'll make you pay for it. Our counterfeit gods will always hold carrots out in front of us. If only you give a bigger thing, make a greater sacrifice, do more, try harder, then you'll get it. But in the end, they will not be there for you at all. This is what empty idols are like. They can't be God, and they can't do what God does. Your career is great. It's incredibly important. I'm sure you're talented for it, and it is a wonderful thing. But it isn't God. And so career success will not actually heal you at all. Money is a part of life, but it isn't divine. And so your financial muscle will not keep you out of the grave. It's lovely having friends, but they're not God. Your popularity with strangers and those around you will not make you holy and acceptable. Your children are awesome most of the time, but they will not make you eternal. Religious fanaticism, legalism, will not lead you to the forgiveness that you crave. In fact, every time you seek divine intervention from human inventions, there will be no response, no answer, no one will pay attention, they won't even know your name. And so there we have it, right? Baal isn't God. That's what we need to do, is get rid of our idols, cut them out, throw them to the curb. If you're part of a particular type of Christianity like we are, you talk a lot about idols. Right now, you know yours. It's fun. It's like the Enneagram. I've got a comfort one. I've got this. I've got that. And we think that's enough to say, yeah, I know what my idols are. But ancient Israel's need and our need is not just to expose the futility of our false beliefs. We don't just need to see that they're not real. We also need the clarity of seeing and knowing God for who he truly is. Nothing banishes a counterfeit like the real thing. And so, after the humiliation of the prophets of Baal, Elijah steps up and he repairs the altar. He makes his sacrifice. And then he has people pour buckets and buckets of water all over it, so much so that the trench around it is beginning to be filled with water. And it's been a while, but here's the reminder. The thing is supposed to catch fire. The goal is to see which God will answer with fire, and here's Elijah dumping it with water. And then he stands back, and he says this, starting in verse 36. He says, at that time of the offering of oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and he said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me that these people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that I have turned, and that you have turned their hearts back. And then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stone and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. After hours of seeing the prophets of Baal do their dance and their trance and nothing happening, I can imagine the crowds thinking, we're about to see more of the same. That's usually how it is with our idols versus God. We kind of expect God to be like our idols. Yet, immediately, as soon as Elijah utters these words, as soon as he prays that the people would know that the Lord was God, as soon as Elijah asks, fire falls from heaven and it consumes everything. There's nothing left, not the stones, not the dust, not even a drop of water. God doesn't abandon Elijah, but answers him immediately. Elijah doesn't bleed. Elijah doesn't beg. He doesn't even ask a second time. And what happens is an undeniable action of God to reveal himself as the true God. And immediately the people know. They fall on their faces. And for the first time in the entire story, they actually say something worthwhile. They say, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." It's a confession, it's worship, it's a call to worship. They know, they saw, they declared, and they abandoned Baal. God had made himself known as the completely worthy one of belief. It's at this moment they see and they know that he is worthy of following. Baal isn't God, so we're not gonna follow him. But God truly is, so we will follow him. This kind of powerful revelation of God isn't a one-off occurrence. On the shore of the Red Sea, after God had redeemed them out of Egypt and had toppled Pharaoh in front of their eyes, they stood on the shores and they sang a song of joy to God, their Redeemer. Or at the ruins of Jericho, after the stronghold had fallen before their eyes, they sang songs yet again, praying and declaring their mighty God who gives them what he promised. Or at the feet of Goliath, David praises God, saying, "The Lord, he's done this thing today." What happens with Elijah on Mount Carmel is not a one-off event, because this is who God is. This is what he is like. He is the maker of heaven and earth. He always finishes what he starts. The God of Abraham and Sarah redeems what is lost. The God of unfailing love seeks the prodigal always. The God of compassion demonstrates his power with justice. He's not manipulated by your morality. He isn't cajoled by your righteousness. He doesn't demand your flesh from you. God freely makes himself known over and over again. He speaks, he acts, he responds, because it's who he is. He is the Lord, he is God. Again, this is not a one-off event. This is the claim and the truth of Christianity. In a small village in an ancient Roman colony, a baby was born in a manger. God made flesh. God revealed in perfect clarity the very image of the radiance of God. And the boy grew up, and with his words, his actions, his declaration, in all of those things, he was making the invisible God visible before the people. The Lord, he is God. And then on a hillside, Jesus bleeds and dies, and the sky turns to night, and the veil in the temple is ripped, and the ground shakes as Jesus gives his life for us. And the Roman guard who's assigned to watch Jesus die declares, in an echo of the people of Israel in this passage, he declares, "Surely this man was the Son of God." And then out of the tomb, he comes alive. There's no greater display of God's power and victory than Christ's dismantling of death. Never has there been a more crushing defeat to evil than Jesus rising. The Lord Jesus is God. While you're captivated by the things of this world, Christ, in his rich mercy and grace, has interrupted human history and made himself known and redeemed all things. Mount Carmel is just a foretaste of Calvary. The Lord is God. And there's only one thing left. There's really only one thing left. There's only one response. Believe and follow. He is God. Just as the people of Israel did, confess that Jesus is Lord and place all your hope in him. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.